From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Each week we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, a special presentation of a lecture by university professor and Nobel Peace Prize recipient Elie Wiesel. Professor Wiesel is on sabbatical this year, but is still chosen to address the university community in a continuation of his annual series called The Fascination with Jewish Tales. This evening, he takes as his theme, Why Care? Here now is Professor Elie Wiesel.
A definition first. Caring, what does it mean? Of course, it means a readiness, a willingness to interfere, and indeed to intervene in someone else's life. And, if possible, to shield it from mishaps and misfortune. Does it mean that to intervene, to care about another person, is to play God? Rather, it means to recognize the humanity of the other, forever frail, vulnerable, and threatened by falling victim to loneliness and despair. In more ways than one, living in society implies interference. Parents, teachers, elected rulers who govern organized structures, aren't they, aren't we, living symbols of intervention? These days of turbulence and convulsion all over the world, the obligation to care, thus to intervene, seems more urgent than ever. How many fires have ravaged cities and communities on how many continents? But some, near or far, through the power of the media, compel us to look and be aware and take a position. For then we may not turn our gaze away with impunity. In other words, in this age of instant communication, ignorance is no longer an excuse. But then, was it ever an excuse? Geographical distances seem to have vanished altogether. When children starve in Somalia or Sudan, we know about it, as we do when women weep over the massacre of their parents, husbands, and children. In a very real and concrete sense, the transformation from the unknown to the known is immediate. And so the pain of orphans, the injustice done to innocent men and women are of concern to us. They implicate us from the mysterious yet noble principle of human relations and responsibility. For we are all responsible for one another. And as a teacher, I would say, I am more so. Every one of us must say the same thing. I am more responsible because I say I. Whoever says I can therefore imply all the others who in turn say I. When I am slapped in the face, said Kafka, it is humanity itself that falls to the ground. Joseph K.'s absurd death foretold that of millions. To allow the racist to humiliate, the tormentor to torture, and the assassin to murder would mean to surrender our freedom, our sovereignty, and our honor to their brutal laws and ideals. If there is in the human being an area which remains inhuman, it is not his or her taste for cruelty, but their choice to avoid involvement and decide not to care. But then, what does it mean? It means that one must choose also an old virtue, compassion. But compassion for whom? The victims, sure. But what about the victimizer? Must we have compassion for the victimizer too? What about his children? They are only children, and yet their father was a killer. In the plague, Albert Camus raises the question whether one can become a saint without God. And Camus' answer actually is yes. The agnostic says yes, it is possible to choose a life of such kindness, of such involvement, that one becomes a saint. Well, what he says may be valid, but the opposite may be true as well. In our common religious texts, we are called upon to love our neighbor, or we call our neighbor v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, meaning our fellow man or woman, as we love ourselves. Well, the whole verse is v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, thou shalt love your fellow human being as you love yourself, ki ani ad Hashem, for I am the Lord. So humbly and respectfully, I would like to move the comma in the verse. And I would say, v'ahavta l'reacha, you shall love your fellow man or woman, comma, ki ani ad Hashem, kamocha ani ad Hashem, for I, the Lord, am like you. It means something special. It means that we are turning around the imitatio Dei, and we say it is not the human being who will imitate God's attributes and be merciful like him and forgiving like him and good like him and just like him, but the other way around. It is God who will follow his creature's ways. I, your Lord, will behave towards you the way you behave towards my other creatures. You are kind to them, I will be kind to you. And this is actually what we find in the prophet Zechariah, who is quoting the Lord speaking to his people. Do you really think that I care about what you eat or refrain from eating? Improve your manners towards the other. That is what really matters to me. At this point, since Dr. Silber spoke about tradition, let me follow our traditional way of opening parentheses. And, of course, always begin with gratitude. I want to thank Jodi Anderson and her competent staff at all university functions, Amy, Judith, Jocelyn, Karen, Mark, Ken, and Mitchell. Thanks to the ushers who are all president's hosts. Thanks to my colleagues, always. I think of my colleagues who received me 27 years ago when all of us were young. And we tried to get older and we succeed. This is our great success, sure. I want to thank my students always, those who are here, those who have not been here. I meet them occasionally when I travel. And no joy is greater to me as a teacher, really, than to meet my students. Not one of them has ever disappointed me. And, of course, how not to thank Dr. Silber, who, as you, all of you must know already for years, how close we are. He is the one who brought me here, and it could have failed, but it didn't. We became very close friends, and we still are. Problem with him is now you don't even know how to address him, how to refer to him. Former president, acting president, interim president, and chancellor. Well, for us, he always remains Dr. Silber. He is identified with the university, and no one has done more for this school, for this institution, to give it strength and the taste for excellence, as he has done. And naturally, I want to thank him for his introduction, which is always gracious, forever kind, and original. You wanted to know why I came back from my sabbatical leave to speak tonight. Maybe I came to hear your introduction. Now, back to the topic. Why care, really? Why must one care for one's fellow human being when he or she is in pain, a prisoner of destiny, or a victim of circumstances? Why ought anyone expect from me a gift or a promise? Why should I give anyone of my time, energy, and money to assist unknown persons living or dying in faraway lands, under distant skies, speaking at times alien tongues and following strange customs? Why and in the name of what must one share their suffering, their plight, and sacrifice whatever is required to alleviate it? These questions seem pertinent only to those who look for reasons not to care. In general, people who dwell under a democratic regime ruled by law and motivated by compassion do care. Religious morality, cultural idealism, political ethos, and simple humanism can motivate a citizen to respond to a natural desire to do good, to help the weak, the sick, the aged, the defeated, the forgotten, the minorities. In other words, the helpless. Lota modal dam reyecha is one of the most beautiful and noble commandments in Scripture. Thou shalt not stand idly by. If your neighbor, your associate, or simply your contemporary is being persecuted, victimized, do not be an indifferent onlooker. Isn't this, in one word, the global philosophy of human rights activities that became a kind of universal and universally accepted secular religion following the atrocities of the Second World War? More than 2,000 organizations, associations, committees, and groups working for the idea. And they are there to practice human rights. And these organizations exist on 5 continents. Some are known and wealthy, others small and poor. All are important and all are praiseworthy. They do what in many cases their governments fail to do. Their achievements signify official failures. We must admit that. They care because they believe that their elected officials do not. They feel that they must fulfill their moral obligations as citizens of their country or of the world because their chosen leaders do not use their power as leaders to fight poverty, disease, and hatred. But that goes for those who work in those organizations. But what about the individual man or woman? What about a student at this university who just came or who is already here a few years? What can he or she do to change the world, or at least to change the destiny of one group or one person anywhere? Why should they care, since they are so weak, sometimes so inefficient, and although they want to do, but they can't? Who would listen to them? Since we did not ask to be born, to enter this world irrevocably doomed by its own imperfections, why should we not worry only about our own welfare and worry about our own future exclusively? We could live like that, alone or with our family, with our circle of friends, those that we know, those that we love, those that love us. Why must we think of those who are not here? Oh, of course, we know that there is an answer. The answer is actually in the Bible, which deals with human interrelations more than with connections of the human being with God. If I notice someone or his donkey carrying a heavy load, says Scripture, it's my duty to help them both the donkey and the human being. For why? Because we must realize that thou shalt not stand idly by applies to all the situations of all of us, everywhere, at any time. It is for the victim to decide when the load is too heavy. I have no right to say, I know better than you, it's not so terrible. No, the victim tells me what to do. If the victim says, I suffer, who am I to say you don't? Or you don't suffer enough? Or I suffered more than you? I learn, therefore, that I must be sensitive to one another, for I am part of creation, and we are all equally worthy in God's eyes. Furthermore, I must know that I must help not only for the sake of the victim, but for my own, for I know that tomorrow I may be the victim, and tomorrow I may need someone who will look away the way I did if I do. And of course, I must know that we are supposed, if not required, to believe that the Creator of the world cares for its inhabitants. He is involved in their affairs, listens to their pleas, and is concerned with the ways they conduct themselves in adversity or joy. That is the moral philosophy of monotheistic faith. God does not hide himself on an Olympus from his children. God is no stranger to creation. God is just and compassionate even when he is rigorous. When a child cries, God is moved by his tears. With some inexplicable and to me unjustifiable exceptions, when a widow is heartbroken, God sends messengers to console her. When the innocent suffer, God is on their side. When the just person passes away, God sheds tears into the grand ocean, and their sound reverberates from one corner of the world to the other. That's what we learn from our sources. I may question this statement. Does he always? Did he, when his children were condemned to perish in flames, did he join his suffering to ours when few others did? Is that part of God's pathos, which to us may be so removed because we are not God? How did Eliezer HaKalir, the great poet of the 8th century, say about God and his ways? Ilu yedativ heyitiv. If I knew God, I would be God. But then I understand that I must believe that God is involved. But there are certain things I don't understand. What I do not understand is, why does God care about small things in my life and behavior? Why does he care whether human beings are good or bad, whether they offer him praise or make him sad? Whether at times a human being who is but a speck of dust, lost in the vast, boundless cosmos, misses a prayer, eats forbidden food, flirts with a beautiful woman, or transgresses a petty law or custom which doesn't hurt anybody, why should he care? Would a king worry over such foolish or childish misbehavior by an anonymous peasant who wanders around in one of the nameless hamlets of his kingdom? Is it that God cares even about futile matters so as to serve as an example to his creatures? Is that why he cares? As if God were to tell every one of us, be just, since I am just about anything. Matters of detail are important. small things can hurt more than terrible tragedies. A gesture which is not made, a word that is not uttered, a slap in the face when a consoling word would be in order, a disappointment about someone who was near you. Why should you care? But God says, yes, these small events or gestures make life what it is. Is that why he cares about small matters? In the same line of questioning, we may wonder, why does God need so much praise from us? It is said that Genghis Khan had a historian in his entourage, and who wrote, this historian, wrote such flattery of his powerful master that the tyrant thought that he was ridiculed and had him executed. Well, God dislikes flattery, says the Midrash. He doesn't. Read our prayers. Are they simple statements of our humility and nothing else? Is there a prayer that does not praise God for his mercy, his wisdom, his power, his intelligence, his fairness, his memory, and whatnot? The list often seems endless. We say to him, "Takol bara lichvodo," that in creating man, he created everything to his glory. His whose glory? God's? Is the opposite also possible? Namely, that God created the universe and everything in it to man's glory, so that human beings could elevate themselves above reality, above the present, above the everyday events in their life, just by thinking of God and his attributes, so that man could truly try to be worthy of being fashioned in God's image by helping a neighbor, a colleague, an acquaintance, a fellow student or a pilgrim, a patient in the hospital, a madman or a beggar humiliated by society. In other words, are we to be compassionate simply because we believe that compassion is the source not only of memory, of God's memory, but the source of life itself? But then, again, are there limits to compassion? Can I have compassion for the killers? I was invited to go recently to go to testify in The Hague. And to testify actually in favor of someone who was not the worst, but not the best. And his lawyer actually said, try to understand, he was not so bad, and why not plead for compassion? And my answer was, what about the victims? I feel my first loyalty must be to the victims, not to the victimizer. Of course, on a certain level, we are compelled to affirm not only God's greatness, but also his uniqueness. God alone is alone. Human beings are not and must not be. Thus, in caring for others, we obey God's will regarding our humanity. It is defined and measured by our capacity and desire never to allow a lonely person to remain locked in his or her solitude. Though we are unable to save them from entering the ultimate solitude, which is death, we can be with them while they are alive. 1 minute before a person leaves us for the world to come, we can tell him or her that they are not alone, that they are still immortal. Is that sufficient? That's for the other person to answer. For in truth, we care not only for the sake of the other, but for our own as well. If I leave the lonely person in his or her loneliness, when they need a human presence, my own humanity is in jeopardy. If I don't exist for them in hours of need, no one will exist for me in my own. If I am insensitive to their concerns, to their fear, to their anguish, to their agony, to their waiting for redemption, I may be condemned by my indifference to live a life devoid of meaning and hope and die before I die. Of course, speaking about caring, how can one not speak about what's happening today in the world? And today we have the simple and tragic question. Do we care? And now we know that what I just said applies to us today. If we don't care, who will care for us? Is it too late, perhaps? It's not only about the Middle East, I'll speak about that, but in general. I'll tell you a story, a true story, which was a silly story, but a true story. When I came to America, I had an accident immediately afterwards. I write about it in my memoirs. I was hit by a taxi, as you know, on Times Square, and passed out immediately. I was very severely injured. The ambulance came 20 minutes later, took me to one hospital. The hospital checked my pockets, realized I was a refugee, stateless, had no money. They put me back on the ambulance. Took me to a second ambulance, to a second hospital. Same thing. Three hospitals rejected me because I had no money and no insurance and nothing. Then, 10 days later, I came to, and I had colleagues at the United Nations. I was a correspondent then in the United Nations, and they came to visit me. One of them, his name was a man named Alexander Sauber, a Hungarian Jew who made Aliyah in the 20s or 30s, and he had a newspaper in Israel called Iton Meyuchad, which was a kind of yellow newspaper. Really, yeah, only about crimes and so forth. At that time, there were no crimes in Israel, believe me. There wasn't a single murder case at that time. We were not a normal people then. And he had a tremendous sense of humor. He would come and he would try to make me laugh. He didn't realize that whenever I was in a cast until here, whenever I laughed, it hurt, you know. But he went on making me laugh. And one day he says to me, you know, really, you must be thankful to God. It could have been worse. I said, what do you mean it could be worse? Look at me. It could be worse, he said. I said, come on, you know that when the taxi hit me, they broke my greatest treasure. I had a pen, the only pen I had, and it broke. It could be worse. I said, come on, it will take months until I will get off. Could be worse. I went on each time, it could be worse. I said, you know, I don't know where, but my things in the hotel, I had no money to pay for the hotel. Could be worse. Finally, I asked, tell me, what could be worse? He said, it could have happened to me. Well, these days, it happens to us. It happens to all, meaning we thought in the beginning that when the suicide killers killed only in Israel, it was limited to Israel. It wasn't. Now we know Bali and even the Moscow massacre there of the Chechenians, all that. Some people, terrorists today, realize that when they practice a cult of death, it's possible to obtain more results, at least certainly more press, more visibility. And then you had another suicide hijackers of 9/11, which means nothing is limited now. Whatever happens in one place affects all the others. So what do we do? In our case, of course, we must ask in America, what should America do? Should we go to Iraq? And if not, what do we do against terrorism? We proclaimed, the President proclaimed, Senate, House proclaimed that terrorism is the enemy. And I believe it is. How do you fight it? Where do you begin? What do you do? When the enemy is anonymous, hiding, using methods and weapons that we never imagined they could. So now, we know what they are doing. In Israel, at least, we know. They kill mainly children. You know, when I see this, in general, all my life, I was haunted by the sight of children whenever I espoused the cause for human rights, it was always rooted in children. And there you see children being killed, you know, the last murder before the Hebron, the Shabbat massacre. How can anyone kill a child with a, in his mouth? How can they? I don't know. And they did. Bullet in the neck or in the head. The mother tried to protect them with her body. She too was killed. So what is it? What is happening to this world? Have you learned? Have you learned anything? And if so, what were the lessons? Why didn't we receive those lessons with more eagerness and more sincerity in order to learn and to teach? And does it mean, therefore, that I should not think about the others? It's impossible. Look, you think of these teenagers, the adolescents, who are trained, taught, and conditioned by their teachers who preach hatred day after day, and by their parents who turn them into emissaries of death. You have seen, I'm sure you have seen on American television everywhere, a mother saying that she just lost a son. She said she has four more. My God, four more. They call themselves Shahid, martyrs, and we know what martyrdom is. All of us knew in our tradition. We Jews had our martyrs, Christians had their martyrs, we had martyrs. But we have learned one thing. A martyr is someone who is ready to die for his or her faith, not someone who is ready to kill for someone's faith. So where did we go wrong in not teaching certain lessons? I know from my memory that my generation has suffered because the world didn't care. And this is something which I repeat because it has to be repeated. It bears repetition. The world didn't really care. Oh, there was a world war. Roosevelt waged war, valiant war, great war, a just war against Hitler. He and Churchill, they should always be remembered with gratitude. But when it came to us, now we know more even than then that Churchill and Roosevelt knew before we did, and that didn't play a role. When American Jewish leaders came to see him, and very weakly, timidly, they pleaded for the Jews in Europe, Roosevelt's answer was always, let's win the war, that's the best way. No, there were two wars, the general war and the war against the Jews, and that war was neglected. Look, I remember Transylvania 1944, my time. A few weeks before Normandy, the war was virtually over. The Red Army had reached the nearby Carpathian Mountains. There wasn't a single capital in the free world where the existence of death factories was unknown. Yet no one bothered to inform us, much less help us. It was 600,000 Jews whom Eichmann and his units were rounding up in towns like mine. Everybody knew except we. Everybody knew in Stockholm and in the Vatican and in Washington and in Switzerland and everywhere what Auschwitz meant, except we didn't. Why didn't we? Didn't care. Now, again, had we been warned, we would have fled into the mountains. We had, Russians were so close, we could have done it. And they were good people. I always speak about them. We had a maid, an illiterate peasant woman, marvelous woman. She was the honor of Christianity, and she came to plead with us. She didn't know either, but she came to plead with us to be with her in the mountains, in the hut. If we had known, why didn't we? The world didn't care. Let's face it. The Jews were expendable. Hitler understood it. His decision to implement his so-called final solution was not a sudden one. It was preceded by numerous plans, smaller in scope, designed to measure their impact on the free world. After each blow, he waited. Only when he realized that no one would do more than pay lip service did he give the Eichmanns the green light. And 10,000 human beings perished daily. Hitler must have known that FDR had rejected ridiculously modest pleas to bomb the railways leading to Auschwitz. The pretext, not a single bomb could be diverted from this overall war effort, said FDR. While FDR justified his decision, Jews from all villages entered the Kingdom of Night. Question: had Hitler been content with fulfilling his pledges relating to the Jewish question? In other words, had he stayed in Poland and exterminated its Jews without invading Belgium and France, without declaring war or being in war with England, would the free powers have waged war against the Third Reich? It's a very powerful question, a painful one. Did the war end in 1945? If so, why are so many youngsters falling week after week on battlefields all over the world? Why so much blood being shed? So much hatred being spread? One war has ended, but others, many others, have replaced it. Political wars, religious wars, tribal wars. A bizarre combination of the Middle Ages and the nuclear era. Social conflicts, racial tensions, economic upheavals. Our society has never been as divided, as torn from within. And the vocabulary sounds familiar: ghettos, discrimination, hunger, tactics of cruelty. Haven't we made any step forward? We walk on the moon, but haven't managed to come closer to our neighbor or to ourselves. We try so hard to push back the horizon that we now live with no horizon at all. In conquering space, we forget our soul. We think our minds dominate matter, whereas they are dominated by it. The war ended in 45, but who won it? Are all its victims buried? What about those of today and tomorrow? How many of us display some awareness of the nuclear menace, bacteriological menace, biological weapons? Just imagine terrorism with bacteriological weapons, what it could do. Ask my colleagues who teach physics or chemistry or biology in this university and in our neighboring institutions. They will tell you, and you won't sleep at night, what could be done and what they would do if not stopped. So, when you think about all this, of course you wonder, what have you learned? I have learned mainly negative things. I have learned my lessons were what not to do, meaning what I'm against. Why I'm against? I'm against ignorance. That's why I teach. I've seen that ignorance can lead humanity to its doom. Ignorance means not only the past, but also to use it for the future. I'm against hunger, famine. There is no excuse for people dying of hunger these days. And there are people in the thousands in Africa and Asia dying of hunger. And you see, you cannot not see in the papers and on television their faces, the children dying in the arms of their mothers, simply famine. In the book of Ezekiel, he speaks about many woes, and he also speaks about famine, and he uses the expression cherpat raav, the shame of hunger. I never understood. Why should a hungry person feel shame? Isn't it enough that a hungry person is hungry? Why should he or she feel shame? And then I understood. It's not a hungry person who should feel shame. I should feel shame. I've learned that. I've learned, of course, to be against racism. It is stupid. Racism has always been stupid. Not only unfair, unjust, but it is stupid to believe that one race is better than the other because of his or her color. I'm against hatred, of course, because hatred is ugly, the language of hatred is vulgar, and hatred has never produced any great work of art or beauty. I'm against comparisons. I don't like to hear or to read statements saying it could be worse or it was worse. No. 9/11, I remember that day, a friend of mine who was a Holocaust survivor called me up and he said, look, because he heard my statements already, I was shattered. He said, remember, at that time they spoke in New York 5,000, now it's only 3,000, 5,000. He said, look, remember when we were there, it was 12,000 a night. I said, please, don't even repeat it. Don't even make it as a wrong comparison. Don't even mention it. It would be unfair to the victims and their families of today. It would diminish their suffering. They are entitled to their suffering, at least. Oh, I'm against humiliation. And all of these before meant humiliation. Hunger is humiliation. A person, a father who cannot feed his children is humiliated. A mother who cannot bring solace to her children is humiliated. And humiliation, therefore, is a sin which we should not allow. I'm against silence. I am for silence in literature. I'm in redemptive silence. But I'm against silence which is neutrality, which means when somebody needs my voice and I keep silent, I'm guilty. For at the end, of course, I am against indifference. As you heard John Silver mention, which is true, I dedicated my life against it. So here we come, therefore, now to the almost in conclusion. What do we do? We as Jews, or we as human beings here in this school who try to learn something about the nature of civilization and culture, the role of culture in morality, what do we do when the Middle East has become now a kind of source of danger? Lo and behold, things could happen so fast if we are not careful, if they are not careful, that the Third World War could begin there. Without even realizing that we are there. It could become. I could give you 5 scenarios at least, each leading towards that. What do we do? I must have spoken about it here in the last. I don't like to blame people. I'm ready to fight ideas, but not human beings. And everybody is a human being. I felt that Arafat was to blame. Now his own people, thank God, say that he was to blame. He made too many blunders, too many mistakes. He could have entered history as the first president of the first Palestinian state in history. There was never a Palestinian state. Then Barak offered him the concessions that he will never get again. A few weeks ago, we had dinner forgive me for name-dropping, but it's important for the story, with President Clinton and President Havel. And Clinton repeated again, told us a story about how it happened, the last Camp David agreement. It's incredible. Arafat didn't even say why he said no. He simply said no. So, of course, I blame him, but then he will disappear. The next elections, they'll elect him probably as a president who will have ceremonial attributes, but no more. And younger people may take over, and I hope they will, and become more lenient. But what could I say, let's say, to a Palestinian young student here, Boston University, who would say to me, you know, Professor Wiesel, really, how can you not understand us? When you see what's being done to us, we had a home, we had homes, they are destroyed. We wanted a country, we cannot have it. And look, after all, our children are also wounded, killed. How can? This is not a new problem for me. Because years ago, at one in the Middle West, I gave a lecture. And a young student got up and asked me that question without any anger, Just ask me the question. Palestinian. But I simply, then, I was so moved with it then, because he wasn't angry, he wasn't insulting. Then I then had a correspondence with him. I met other Palestinians. I had relations with them. Since 9/11, they refuse any contact. I have no more. And what I did then, I wrote one of the letters I published, and it's part of one of my books. What I wrote to this young Palestinian is the following. Permit a Jew to speak to you of what distresses him about you. Allow him to think aloud in your presence about what stands between us. He does it in good faith, hoping only to ascertain whether bonds might still be formed that will transcend mistrust, in spite of the blood that has been shed. I know. Only he who has suffered himself may speak of human suffering. To turn suffering, someone else's suffering, into an abstraction is as offensive as making it into a tool for propaganda. It is never theory, nor is it caricature. It is as it is in its own core, measurable only against itself. I'm aware of this, and yet I ask you not to turn away. My purpose is not to offend you. On the contrary, I should like to convince you of my desire to understand you, to make you understand me. This possibility of an exchange between us is important to me, believe me. It is my wish that I become reality for you. It's my wish that perhaps tomorrow somewhere our exchange may come to be seen as an example. Since your pain is what separates us, let's confront it. I seek neither to evade nor to minimize its impact. Let's examine it. And facing this pain, facing you, I plan to judge myself as well, since someone else's suffering always puts us to the test. Whatever my conclusion or my position, it will be frank and sincere with you and with your adversaries, my brothers. This is a moral obligation, not a political undertaking. I draw this to your attention from the start because I do not understand and am wary of politics. Perhaps there is nothing to understand. As a modern esoteric science, politics confuses the facts it is meant to clarify. Does it help prevent conflicts or incite them? Let us say that it frequently opposes while it conciliates only temporarily. Let's leave politics aside, or there would be no end to it. Politics is like war. Easy to start, but difficult to end. The arguments on both sides are valid. You invoke Palestine's Muslim past. I shall speak of the Jewish past that preceded it. You denounce the injustice endured by Arab refugees in 1948. I shall do the same. But I shall point out that those who truly bear responsibility for it are your own leaders, with their incendiary speeches, their virulent fanaticism. If only they had accepted the United Nations resolutions on the partition of Palestine. If only they had not incited the Arab population to mass flight in order to return forthwith as victors. If only they had not attempted to drown the young Jewish nation in blood. If only they had taken into account Jewish suffering also, the Jewish right to also claim its sovereignty on its ancestral land. For 30 years, Israel's peace initiatives were ignored. Israel's appeals for mutual recognition were denied. Israel's conciliatory moves were rejected. Words, rhetoric, I resort to them to show you that if our common problem were exclusively of that order, I could accept it. I would know how to deal with it. Even though this is an area in which yours are weighty assets, money, oil, allies from the third world, today it's easy for you to buy anything, arms or votes. How you must despise those suppliers, those clients, those diplomats kneeling before the oil god, crawling to be granted your favors. What could my people possibly offer them? No money, no deals, no bloc alliances. Only a sense of history, a yearning for justice, and also a sense of honor. If it were merely a matter of political or economic advances, I could succeed in convincing myself that this is how it has to be. But what is at stake between us is something else and much more. And so I ask you to look at our relations from an exclusively human point of view. As a Jew, I understand that you defend the Arab cause. As an Arab, please understand that I espouse the Jewish cause. I don't expect you to be objective, as you must not expect me to be. That would be against nature for both of us. But I urge you to put yourself in my place sometimes, as I shall have to put myself in yours sometimes. It's a long letter. I wrote it, you know when? In the early 70s. And it's as topical today, I could have written it today without changing a word. The early 70s. What do I try to say? I try to say, look, let's talk. If only the leaders of the Palestinians today would realize that hatred is not an answer. Hatred should never be an answer. If they were to realize that death is not a solution, that is never a solution. And therefore, if they could withdraw the textbooks from the Palestinian schools, and I, believe me, again, I'm name dropping, which I never do, you know me, I hope you know me enough. I suggested it to Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the United Nations, that he should speak to Arafat and tell him to change the textbooks. And I said, I guarantee you the budget for the re-editing, for the re-impression. We will print new books without hatred. Look, they have a cause. I said, let them say that. Let them speak. Yes, they have a cause. They have an argument. They can speak. And people will listen. We will listen without hatred and without killing, without suicide killing. Even terrorism used to be a romantic movement, but even terrorism had limits. I'm sure I must have spoken to you about it, because it always made an impression on me. I studied the history of terrorism for years. I studied it when I wrote Dawn. I wrote it in the late 50s, and it's about Palestine, before 48. I wrote about the Jewish undergrounds, and I was not part of them. I was in Paris when all that happened. When a Jewish underground member was ordered to kill a British major as reprisal for the execution by the British of a Jewish underground member. And I remember I studied it. I wanted to understand what was happening. How can one do that? I don't know how. So I studied terrorism. And at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, they were called revolutionaries, they were called anarchists, they were called nihilists, they had all kinds of names, and they were romantic. They killed. But once they decided to kill the governor of Petersburg, St. Petersburg, and everything was there. Everything was ready. It was ready. The man was dead. He didn't know that he was dead. They had people waiting at every corner at the street. They knew where he would go the coming Sunday, and there was no way that man was dead. Except the last minute, he decided to take his children with him. And these terrorists couldn't do it. They couldn't kill children. Cannot. The governor? Sure. His bodyguards? Sure. Children, they cannot. Dostoevsky wrote a novel about it, and Camus wrote a play about it. And his play is called The Just. In his play, there's a marvelous passage in which the revolutionary explains to his superior why he couldn't kill the children. Which means that's why he couldn't kill the governor. He said, look, I know that our fight, our cause is just. We are against despotism. We are against the inhumanity of the system. We are against it. But if I were now to kill children, I would then become an unjust system like them. and I would become the wrong solution to human problems. This is what I would say. If there is hope still, I would say, please, even at war, it happens that both sides must sign certain conventions. The Geneva Convention, when they decided not to use gas after the First World War, let there be a convention. Suicide killing must be outlawed. I mean, no one should accept it. I believe we cannot expect Israel, for instance, to surrender under the threat of terrorism. No civilized government would accept it, nor should accept it, no one. How do we do that? You know, I believe in education. How often do I say that? Whatever the question, I know one thing. The answer is there. And education must be its major component. So that's why we are here. To celebrate education and to believe that it will happen, except it takes a long time. Do we have time? I don't know. So, in conclusion. Conclusion story, you know, a Hasidic story. How can one be here and not tell a Hasidic story, which I'm sure my students at least know. It is the story, the famous story by Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, who says that one day the king had seen that the next harvest will be cursed and whoever will eat from it will go mad. So he called his advisor, who was his best friend, and here there are two versions. One version says that he said to the advisor, look, I'll tell you something. When the time comes, everybody will eat from it, you too and I too. But I will put a sign on your forehead and you on mine. And whenever I will look at you and you look at me, we will know at least, you and I will know that we are mad. The other one is nicer. The other one is, the king said, look, I'm going to build a granary and I'm going to store in the granary all the grain from the last harvest. And when the time comes, my entire people will eat from the cursed grain, me included. But only you, you alone, will have the key to the granary and you will remain sane. But there is a responsibility in that. Then everybody will be insane. It will be your task to go from town to town, from village to village, from house to house, from marketplace to marketplace, from school to school, and you will shout with all your might. Men and women, don't forget. Men and women, don't forget. You are mad. I think this is what we must do today, in a way. Students, teachers, writers, journalists, poets, musicians. We must tell the whole world, look, you are mad. What's happening? Madness has erupted in history again. It's maddening. We must find a way out, which means we must find a way to bring humanity back to its senses and care for each other. Thank you.
You've been listening to University Professor and Nobel Peace Prize recipient Elie Wiesel speaking on Why Care? In his annual series of lectures entitled The Fascination with Jewish Tales. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Keith Infantino with help from Andy Farnsworth and Vince Fairchild. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.